This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As President Trump prepares to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping, the G20 summit in Argentina this week, a new report from Stanford's Hoover Institution finds that China is ramping up its attempts to meddle in American democracy. The report says, quote, except for Russia, no other country's efforts to influence American politics and its society is as extensive and well-funded as China's, end quote. The authors, many of whom have long advocated for engagement with China, describe new efforts by the Chinese government to influence universities, media outlets, think tanks, and other institutions. Joining us to discuss the report is Orville Schell, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society and co-chair of the Working Group on Chinese Influence Activities in the United States, which authored the report with Stanford's Hoover Institution. And Orville Schell, welcome to Forum.
Pleasure.
Good to have you back with us. This report, let's just say from the beginning, was released today, and it's quite a pivot. It's quite a turnaround because many of these experts, including you, were once champions of engagement, now pretty skeptical, viewing China's undermining democracy. What's really accounted for this turnaround?
Well, I think several things. I think it's important to remember that it's not just trade and business that is out of level in terms of the playing field in which we play with China, but also many other realms of our interaction, such as universities, think tanks, the media, and others. And that this is a in other words, I think it's fair to say that China is not as open to the United States, whether it's in terms of investment or the ability of a newspaper to publish or a television channel to have a network there, as China has here, and many other realms as well. And that this has become an issue now because the nature of the changing relationship and the notion that China is no longer so actively engaged in the process of reform, which means that we cannot assume that China is becoming more congenial, more convergent with the established order of things, much less Western liberal democracies. So this sort of casts our whole interaction into a whole very different frame of reference, where things which before we might have thought were relatively benign now look very differently because China's values and its system is different. And that is what is, in some measure at least, being projected.
So the report talks about promoting constructive vigilance and says that we need transparency, we need a bigger role for NGOs for monitoring and investigating illegal activity by the Chinese. I'm also struck by the fact that there was one dissenter from the group, and that was a Professor Susan Shirk, who's a professor at UC San Diego, and she essentially has gone on record as saying that we're too concerned here about, well, things that are both illegal and maybe in many instances not illegal. In other words, let me quote her here. Actually, she's saying the report undermines it's pretty strong language, undermines dramatic institutions, but that's not the case. And she is afraid that it's going to create too much anti-Chinese feelings.
Well, I think there are two issues here, and Susan Shirk is a colleague of mine and someone I work very closely with and value her judgment. I think it is always dangerous to launch a movement which might ricochet back in our society in a way that would demonize any one group. And I think her concern that we might be demonizing Chinese, because in actuality, the whole sort of Chinese Communist Party's conceit in what they call united front work is primarily to use the overseas Chinese diaspora to claim a certain sort of measure of their patriotism as ethnic Chinese. And this, I think, is something one has to be very careful about, because Chinese are an extraordinary part of our society. They've made a huge contribution, and their loyalty to our country. I'm married to a Chinese. So the last thing I think any of us want to see is any kind of a McCarthyite witch hunt. That said, I think we have to be very flinty-eyed and realistic that China is seeking influence now. It's no longer content just to stay at home. to hide it, bide its time and keep its head down in Deng Xiaoping's parlance, but that it is seeking to reach out in many ways, not just in trade and investment, but also to project its own scheme of things, its own notions of politics, of values. And China has television networks, radio networks, magazines, newspapers, websites in the United States, and is able to do that with impunity. We can't even have the New York Times website unblocked in China, much less the newspaper distributed. And it would be a very, I think, unlikely prospect that we would ever have a television network there, as China does with Global Chinese Television International. So there's a huge imbalance here. And I think that's what the report is trying to call into question, a lack of reciprocity and also a kind of an effort, for instance, in universities to control the narrative and to intrude in a way which I think is in contravention with some very basic principles such as free expression and freedom of the press in the U.S.
In fact, you mentioned the concern about demonizing Larry Diamond, and the afterword brings this up. Essentially, he says it should not be, China should not in any way be demonized in all this. But there are instances of real pressure, not only particularly on university students who happen to be here from China, and stories about some of them. The report actually cites a Chinese student who gave a graduation speech, talked about the fresh air in the United States with freedom and all that, and she came under attack by the Chinese government. Her family came under attack and was harassed. I mean, there's some specific stories here, and these specific stories are of concern. I'm just wondering, though, at this point, with President Trump meeting Xi Jinping in Argentina, how much of this has to do with the relationship between those two? Donald Trump claims that they're, you know, on very good footing and they get along just fine, and that's been his statement consistently despite the trade wars, as they're called.
Well, I think he has sought to maintain the semblance of a friendly relationship, which actually is proper with Xi Jinping, because, like it or not, we need to deal with China. I mean, China's not going to go away. And I think the thing that we are concerned with is, what is the best way to deal with China? What's the proper mix of embracing, keeping the door open, recognizing that we have to get along, want to get along, but on the other hand, not just opening ourselves in a supine way to a one-way street where Chinese can invest in high-tech firms here and we can't there, where whole sections of the economy in China are closed off to U.S. investment, or the media, where think tanks can't establish offices that are really free and independent there, but a Chinese can set up a think tank here in a heartbeat and no one thinks anything about it. So there's a huge disparity here. And it increasingly, I think, has to do also with a projection of a very different kind of system and a different kind of values, which doesn't value open discussion, freedom of expression, and things like that, which lie very much at the fundament of our own country.
We're talking with Orville Schell. He's director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society and co-chairs a working group on Chinese influence activities here in the United States, which authored the report with Stanford's Hoover Institution. And if you have thoughts about this report or questions, we certainly welcome your involvement. We're also talking about a broader perspective of U.S.-China relations, obviously, but we do want to hear from you and your thoughts about the influence of China right now on media, on think tanks here in the United States, and again, any questions you might want to pose. Our toll-free number is available. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and please feel free to call us now, again, at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And Orville, I'm also struck by the fact, and listeners may be certainly aware of this, that Vice President Pence has come out with some strong statements that are really aligned to what this report is essentially focusing on, that is propaganda used by the Chinese government and the attempt to influence and so forth. And yet both President Trump and Vice President Pence feel that there was strong influence of China also in the elections, and that doesn't come across in this report. I mean, that's certainly true about Russia. It's been corroborated over and over again, but the report doesn't seem to go there.
No, and I think it shouldn't go there because, in fact, there's very little evidence that there is intrusion in the political process of America by the Chinese. That's not really what they're seeking to do. They're more seeking to control the narrative about China. But that does not mean that they're not intrusive in ways which I think should be called to account, to call up think tanks and say we shouldn't have this kind of event or that kind of event. The University of California, for instance, in San Diego, asked the Dalai Lama to speak and as a result got all their exchange programs with China canceled, some university scholarships cut off. That kind of punitive action does not contribute to the sort of robust, free kind of discussion, which I think academic freedom compels. And I think it's very important that universities get together to defend each other when they do get in trouble or they run at cross purposes with China. And the same with think tanks, to defend the sort of the basic principles upon which they are founded.
We haven't even talked about technology stealing and all of that, but what I was struck by also in this report is the number of government researchers who are essentially paid by the Chinese and corporate workers, for that matter, and university. I mean, talk about this 1,000 Talents program. This is something maybe that listeners really ought to know about because a lot of these people involved in this really, I think the report points out, ought to be registered as foreign agents. And they're not.
Well, yes. I mean, this is an interesting program funded by China to sort of to fund people in the United States who might then come to China and help irrigate China with sort of high tech innovation and startups. And, you know, in the normal scheme of things, if this were Canada or France, no one would bat an eye. But it all, you see, this is where the idea of interference or influence seeking merges with policy. Because as long as you imagine or can imagine that engagement is still the active principle of the U.S.-China interaction, then a lot of these kinds of interactions seem harmless and quite constructive, actually. But if the worm turns and you begin to see yourself in a state not just of competition, but possibly an adversarial relationship, which involves a very different kind of political system, a one-party state with, you know, where there's surveillance, there's censorship, all of these things. Then you get into a contentious relationship where what might have at one point seemed very anodyne in terms of exchange and interaction suddenly becomes cast in a different light. And this is where technology has turned, I think, in the last year. In a very radical way. So we have the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS, in Washington, with new regulations to control Chinese foreign direct investment in our country in the high-tech area. So there's a whole sea change across almost every sector of U.S.-China policy now as people begin to become more doubtful about China's fundamental nature. So all of these things are sort of connected up in a way which ultimately do get back to how are we going to view China as a friend, as sort of a neutral particle, as a competitor, as an enemy. And that, I have to say, sadly, is in a state of flux. And I think our policy of engagement really hasn't succeeded very well. I mean, it. For most of my life, I could have imagined and did imagine that we were on convergent pathways with Chinese reform slowly changing it. But I think under the present circumstance with the present government of China, it becomes increasingly difficult to imagine that engagement is the most constructive way for the United States to proceed with China.
Now, I think, if I may, John Pomfret, who is a colleague of yours, a member of the working group, in a Washington Post article, said it well. He said, we are at an inflection point, I think, and there's a lot at stake here. I mean, there's cooperating with China on climate change. There's downsizing nuclear weapons. There's a great deal at stake, to put it mildly. Let me get our callers aboard here, though, or Rochelle with us. And so is a caller from San Jose. Sam, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Great show as usual. My question is, Chinese have been stealing our technology for the last 30 years or even more. But why now the alarm is going on? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call. Orville Shaw.
Well, I think partially because China has a program to sort of, by its own confession, to sort of control to lead in sort in high technology, the high technology field, and that they have set a whole series of policies which are essentially protectionist in China, so that the United States can't move into certain fields in China. But they have had the ability until recently to invest and to study and to be involved in those very sectors in our society. So I think we're noticing a kind of change, a reappraisal of this whole idea that if we are training Chinese in areas that have military relevance, for instance, and if in fact the relationship is changing to become more adversarial, is that a good idea? And, of course, you have the whole question of theft of intellectual property, of companies forced in China to do joint ventures, which ultimately give China proprietary ability to take proprietary intellectual property from American companies. All of this is going on. But it should also be said China is doing a lot of amazing innovation on its own. And the question is, how do we view China? Is it a friend? Is it a competitor? Is it an adversary? Is it an enemy? And this is really what is up for grabs in this inflection moment that John Pomfret describes.
Could it also be, Orville, that we're talking about Chinese aggression as part of the whole calculus of what you're presenting here? I'm talking about the South China Sea, of course.
I think the South China Sea has had a tremendously deleterious effect on our ability to imagine engagement as a constructive policy, because with China claiming this vast area from the south of China all the way down to Indonesia, has really rocked a lot of boats. You speak with people at the Pentagon, they're extremely concerned about this. So there are a whole bunch of areas. There's the East China Sea. There's the question of Taiwan. There's the question of Hong Kong. Never mind what's going on within China in places like Xinjiang, where there's a whole movement now to surveil and control and put Muslims into certain kinds of confinement camps.
And forgive me, although we don't hear as much about it, there's also Tibet.
And there's also Tibet, which hasn't gone away. So all of these things are conspiring in a way which I think is very much alarming the whole generation of China specialists who came of age during a time when we were hoping the countries would come closer together. And I think those are the very people who are on this working group. There's some 30 of them from around the world who are very alarmed by the changes and recognize that we have to, at very least, do a roadmap of what China is seeking to do abroad, understand it, be very realistic about it, and look at the policy consequences, but not launch a whole anti-China campaign. I think we've got to keep the door open and hope that there is some ability to flexibility in Beijing, because after all, there are issues like climate change, nuclear proliferation, pandemics, which are the most important issues in the world. And without China, we simply can't solve them. So we're at a very, very difficult fork in the road where we have to get along with China. But we've lost the ability to believe in our own policy of engagement. And we don't quite know what the post-engagement policy will look like.
It's a very important report. I'm just going to wait to see what kind of response, if any, we hear from the Chinese and from Beijing. But let me get another caller aboard. Mark, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. How are you doing? I know somebody who I'm very, very certain has been operating as a type of influencer on behalf of China. And I can just say it took a long time to figure out what was going on, but it's very real. And I think ultimately what, she through a number of events, it seems like there's a lot of work with incubators to try to work with startups, to try to attract talent to come back to China and to make China's standard operating procedures seem normal, that you have to go through the government. It's normal to go through the government to work with a five-year plan and all that. So I just wanted to comment that it is very real, and it's very quiet and it's very subtle. It takes a long time to see what's happening.
Yeah, well, I thank you for that call, Mark. Good to hear from you. And that's the kind of things that are pointed out in the report as well. I'm wondering, though, Orville Schell, about the riskiness of this. You know, you get echoes of anti-Asian hysteria from other periods in our history, and I'm going back again to the dissenter, Susan Shirk, who said she expressed some fears that anti-Chinese versions of the Cold War and the Red Scare may come about, particularly with a president who has, you know, been really, especially in his rhetoric during the campaign, but even now, overreaching in his remarks about the Chinese and their role in terms of being unfair to the United States.
I mean, it's a fair point, and I think one does have to look at many of the things that our government has done in the past and our president's done presently, and be worried. However, I think it would be very foolish for us to, because we fear the consequences of having to act, that we put our head in the sand. I think the first order of business is there a problem? And what is the dimension of that problem? Describe it very matter-of-factly. Look at all the areas, as we have in the report, of where China is seeking influence. Then ask the question, is it in our national interest? What policy challenges does it pose? And then, in a judicious, temperate way, think of how to respond to it. And yes, there is always the fear that we will go overboard. But I think my own view is it's better to have people who aren't sort of ideologically committed take on this issue, who recognize the dangers of a McCarthyism or whatever you want to call it, and to deal with it that way rather than to make it ideological. And I'd much rather be raising this myself than someone who really wants to see the door slammed with China, to see us go back into a deep freeze of the Cold War. It may be satisfying from one level, but again, I raise the question of nuclear proliferation, climate change, and pandemics. How are you going to solve those if you're in a Cold War?
You know, one of the fascinating things in reading this report to me and the people involved in it, I mean, you even have Winston Lord, who was really one of the men most responsible, along with Kissinger and Nixon, for opening up the doors to China.
Yeah, he gave a very eloquent presentation today here in Washington, looking at the long arc and recalling that in 1972, I mean, he was present at the creation with Nixon and Kissinger when they designed the policy that ultimately ended up to be the engagement policy. And he was now saying we need to take a real look at where we are and reassess and reformulate. And I think he's absolutely right.
Let me bring another caller on. Will, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about kind of like how a lot of Americans are very ignorant about China. You know, for example, like if you talk about like the internet, most Americans will think of things like Facebook and Twitter, YouTube, and we don't think about the fact that China, a country with 1.8 billion people, has their own versions of a lot of those being used by way more people. And this can have like huge economic impacts when people start moving towards those platforms because there's a larger market there. You know, if you're an influencer on Instagram and you have 3 million followers, you can get paid to make posts supporting products. Well, why would somebody care about 3 million followers in America when they have like, you know, 10 or 20 million followers in China? And I don't think this has to be a bad thing. But I do think that people should really start paying attention to these things and understanding that there's a much larger market out there. And when you hear things like the American middle class is shrinking and the Chinese middle class is growing, we really kind of have to become aware of the fact that there's a much bigger world out there than just the United States. And that's all.
Point well taken, Will, and thank you. Orville, you want to comment?
Yes, I mean, I think there is a big world out there. But one thing you should, and part of that are things like, you know, WeChat, the Chinese social media, which is prolific and very interesting, but very managed, very controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And the second thing to note is the big world out there is being segmented into what China calls internet sovereignty, namely intranet. Their version of the World Wide Web is not so worldwide. It's we want our web, we'll control the gateways into it, and we don't want to be infected by any worldwide anything. And if this is the future of the web, by analog, this could also be the future of global trade and everything else. But here we are in a global world where we have problems which can only be solved globally. And it is China, in a way, even though in Davos, President Xi Jinping spoke about being in favor of global trade. But in actuality, the logic of what they are doing is sovereign, and it is contained, and it is not open. It is not transparent. And I think that's lies at the sort of the root of some of the contention which we are now feeling with China.
Yeah, you have a president who says America first, and really China has behaved in many ways, which says China first. And despite global rhetoric or things that you've just mentioned, here's what Rick says. I want to get your response to this, Orville. This is kind of strong language, maybe even bordering on what we were saying before about concern over strong anti-Asian feelings. I don't know that Rick feels that way, but listen to what he says. He says, I think that America, with many administrations at fault, has been a pawn for the Chinese. We follow their rules, feed them with our technology, buy everything from them, pay them for our debt, train their kids, and sell our best properties to them. All of these things with not one reciprocal behavior from the Chinese.
Well, I mean, there is a certain logic to that last phrase. There has been, our relationship has been increasingly lacking in reciprocity. And the promise of the World Trade Organization, into which China was admitted with American help, and many other sort of expressions of sort of joint action, was that China would reform and it would change and it would become more reciprocal. But it hasn't. And that's exactly the basis of the trade dispute, the investment dispute, the dispute between civil society organizations, between the media, the universities, think tanks, you name it. It is not reciprocal. Journalists have a very difficult time getting visas and going to China, but hundreds of Chinese journalists come here with impunity. Think tanks can't open up there. Civil society organizations have to register with the Public Security Bureau and are highly constrained in what they can do. So this is a problem.
Orville, we got seconds left. You think that President Trump's going to raise this in Argentina?
Well, I think he's more focused on trade, and we may get some simulacrum of a deal. But the thing to remember is, even if you get a deal on trade, a temporary deal, all of these other things are still out of balance and will still vex our relationship.
Orville Schell, always good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And the report is on our website. Go to kqed.org/forum, and you can read the report. And again, Orville Schell directs the Center on U.S.-China Relations for the Asia Society. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and Christina Kim. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Danny Bringer, and engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Kate Wolf and Josh Koh. Executive editor Ethan Lindsay. Chief content officer Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.